aren't being a proper woman, therefore you must be a witch. You must be a witch.
Winter solstice. We hope you're all warm, enjoying the dark.
Do you remember the song you wrote last year?
Of course. We're going to put it in this episode.
Okay, yeah. Longest night of the year.
Yeah. And we talked about this last year, but that's what we feel about this time is that, you know, we might not necessarily need each other in the way that we used to in the pioneer times where we'll literally starve to death if we don't have community support. I mean, some of us are.
I mean, it's more... it's easier for us to feel like we aren't relying on other people because we can go to the grocery store. But, like, we rely on the farmers and the grocery store clerks.
Of course. Know? Yeah, it's we like, definitely have a lot
like
of reliance.
It's like a more stretched out web that makes us feel more lonely, I think.
Yeah. But, so at this time, like, we used to gather for, like, survival.
Yeah.
And now we still do that, but it's a different kind of survival. It's like a spiritual survival, a connection, you know? I'm mostly a solitary witch. I joke that I'm a hermit. I live in the woods, you know? I very rarely experience that feeling of loneliness because there's, like, just, like, a constant universe happening around me and inside of me, so I don't really get that feeling of loneliness, but I also recognize how important other people are in my life. Again, like you said, not just the people that are in my family or my close friends that I rely on in this way, but also my grocery store clerk or the farmer who grows my cabbage.
And the migrant workers who picked the cabbage for the farmer. I love them. I'm sending you Yule love, workers.
And so that's kind of the theme of this episode. We want to talk about family, but more so about chosen family, about the people who are not necessarily biologically attached to us, because honestly, this can be a very difficult time of year for people, not just because of the darkness, you know, the sun rises at like 9 a.m. and sets at 3 p.m., you know, but because some people just like feel very, what are the words, hurt by their family, or neglected, or alienated, or misunderstood, or, you know, family dinner is just a fight. and that can be very, very difficult navigating and negotiating, especially now when we have so much polarization politically. People are going to their Christmas dinners and not knowing, you know, necessarily what kind of, like, oppressive talk they're walking into. So we want to give a shout out to the people that we choose to have in our lives. And if you don't have a family, a biological family that you can trust, then your friends are your family, you know? I always think about the Golden Girls. How are you going to deny that Rose and Blanche and Dorothy were a family? They had each other's backs. They were there for each other. They supported each other. And just because they didn't have a biological connection, minus Dorothy and Sophia, of course, doesn't change anything about the fact that this is a family.
Yeah.
So, Risa, like, when you go out friend-seeking, what are you looking for in a chosen family member?
That's a good question. I spend a lot of time doing community building for my work and as my chosen passion and profession in life. So I meet a ton of people. I find it pretty easy to get to say, like, if we're talking about, like, a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of intimacy, I find it really easy to get to, like, a 7. Like that. I will let a lot of people into a 7, and I can elicit that from people, you know? Like, I can make people feel safe, and I can, by making myself a little vulnerable with things that I've already processed, you know, like, but to go from a 7 to an 8 or a 9 is very rare. And those people, there's, it's a combination of a real honesty, and a real gentleness. So I'm looking for someone who, is what I aspire to be a little bit when I'm trying to be brave. I wanna offer that next level of intimacy and like show my hurt places and show up for somebody who is gonna reciprocate. And I think I'm looking for that combination of a lack of bullshit and a real gentleness. You know? I have a, like a, you know, you, Christmas for me was very painful for a really long time. I'm from like, what do you politely call like a blended family, right? And my stepdad's family, there was some drinking and really noisy Irish Catholic, a lot of joy there, but a lot of stuff that was terrifying to me from like, you know, my mom's family, we were like farm people in Ontario. I never heard anybody talk really above a whisper, like, you know, and my, you know, my dad, great person and great family, but they just weren't in my life when I was a kid. So I didn't know about the rambunctiousness of the Danes at that time. And I went as a kid and, had like a scary falling out with my stepdad's dad. I saw him shake my little sister when I'd been babysitting her because he was mad that I let them fall asleep in front of the TV. And he was, you know, we picked them up to be like, wake up, go upstairs, what are you doing down here?
Let's just preface for those people who are listening who don't know you personally. Yeah. You have two half-sisters, right, who are younger than you.
And they are younger, the product 10 and 12, of
your mother and your stepfather.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're wonderful.
Right. Yeah. And I'm like jumping into like some of the most intimate shit in my life because I feel like these listeners are like friends of ours and I know you are. So I'm like, here's a story. Yeah. But also it does go back to kind of that Brene Brown thing about like share stuff you've already dealt with. Mm-hmm. You know, like you can be intimate about stuff that you don't have to put your wounds on other people and ask them to heal them for you when you're in the process of working on that. Maybe that's for a therapist or a best friend. But this is stuff that I came to a beautiful conclusion with. So I feel like sharing it. It's a Yule story, if you'll allow me. So I was maybe 12. They came home, loud, scary, yelled at me. I went upstairs. I told my parents that he had shaken the girls. And, you know, looking back, like, I was a pretty dramatic person, and it probably sounded like I was saying he violently shook her, and he, you know, he was, like, waking her up, but nobody was at their best that evening, to be fair.
And you were scared.
I was terrified.
Yeah.
And my mom, in the heat of the moment, said, you never have to come back here. And we drove away the next day, and for over 10 years after that, I never went back.
Can I just shout out your mom real quickly? Because most of us, our experience would have been, be quiet.
Yeah.
Go downstairs. Go give him a kiss. Right. Go give him a hug.
Right.
You know?
So brave and so strong of her.
Yeah.
But what that meant in practice was that they went back without me. And I spent Christmases alone.
At what age?
Starting like early teens.
And you probably as an early teenager were like,
I don't care. I have so many. I like TV.
My mom used that all the time. She'd be like, well, you said you didn't want to go. And I was like, well, I was 13 and my ego had been bruised. So of course I'm going to pretend that I don't want any part of this thing that I've been excluded from.
Yeah.
So, but your sisters would go.
The whole family would go. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how many years there were like that. And, you know, in my head, it really became a painful thing. And I, you know, you have new young kids and you sort of feel on the outs anyway. And you're teenagers, so you feel on the outs of everything anyway. And you live in the suburbs and you fucking hate everything.
And
you're
nobody understands
an anarchist
me.
And nobody gets you. So it all built up into this real bubble of pain that I associated with Christmas, you know. and I love Christmas. I like holidays, you know. Really, I like when any you've got 20 people in a room. I'm like halfway to tears just because people are together, you know. Mm-hmm. So I like Christmas. And you and I have gone to every, you know, Christmas parades for 10 years in a row together, just screaming and crapping, yeah. Screaming and clapping and crying. You love Christmas parades more than anyone I've ever met.
Uh-huh.
And you're a total, like, anarchist, you know, anti-faith in a way, which you're not anti-faith. That's
right. No. I don't know. I think faith is often misplaced, but... yeah, for me, I mean, aside from Yule, which I kind of think of as separate from Christmas.
Yeah.
So we're talking about this, like, Coca-Cola Christmas, you know? To me, it's the absurdity.
Right.
Like, if I could live in the theater of the absurd, which I most times feel like I do.
Yeah.
But these are times, Halloween is another one, you know, where you're on the subway with Lady Gaga and a dinosaur. And it's totally normal and everyone just expects it and that's fine. And Christmas to me is the same thing.
Right.
It's got its own soundtrack. It's got its own color story. We do the most random things. I mean, now that... we are informed pagan witches. We understand why a tree would have been brought into the house and these kinds of things. But as like a modern person who doesn't have that like Yule association, it just seems bananas.
Yeah.
But it's like joyful bananas. Yeah. And those are my favorite kind. That's my favorite kind of crazy.
Right.
Like you've seen me go like absolutely lose my shit. Santa is coming.
Yeah.
And he's coming up the road and I can see his chariot.
Clapping.
And I can see it and I'm screaming because at some point in my life I decided that if you're at a Christmas parade and you can get Santa to like make eye contact with you direct, or if you can get Santa to wave back, you're golden.
Yeah, you're set for the year.
You're set for the year.
Yeah.
And so I make sure, even, you know, as a woman in my
40s. Santa!
And, I mean, it's just, you know, I feel like it's a really good excuse to be a kid again.
Yeah.
For those of us who don't necessarily have, like, a daily practice of, you know.
If you can find, like, a weird neighborhood parade, I highly recommend. Like, actually, today we're recording, and it's the Santa Claus Parade in Montreal. We saw it go by the window earlier. But that's not the one we go to. We would go to the one on Saint-Hubert, under the promenade. This, you know, these weird tiny stores. There's really no floats.
Santa. Pickup trucks.
There's a couple of people, like, drumming and majoretting, and some of them look super stoked to be there, and some of them look like they might be doing some community service hours. It's just the best.
It really is the best.
Find a weird parade, like.
I want to tell a story that you made me think of because this is like a 5-part story, I guess. Because one of my first memories, and also one of my first Christmas memories. Recently, you know this story. So we had gone to visit my Aunt Grace in the nursing home, and I was maybe 3 years old. This is like legitimately one of my first memories, but I remember like it was yesterday. So my family, my sister, my mom and I, we go to visit Aunt Grace and we're all Christmassy and we're singing bumpity bump bump bumpity bump bump look at Frosty go. I remember like it was, I remember what line of Frosty we were on. And Aunt Grace's roommate, who up until this point had just been sitting, maybe you can hear my chair, quietly rocking silently, you know, with that 1,000-yard stare, you know. This is probably a woman who is 105 years old. And we're bumpity-bump-bump, bumpity-bump-bump, look at Frosty go. And this woman's head snaps up, and she screamed, shut up, that awful singing! And this has been like a Christmas tradition that my family has been doing ever since. Every year we're singing Christmas carols and one of us will scream, shut up, that awful singing.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
Now fast forward, Risa and I are friends. We're having this, we used to call it a holler.
Yeah.
Because it's not about singing. Christmas carols are not for
singing.
No. They're just for
being for yelling.
Loud as you can, bumpity bump bump. And so before this parade that we were talking about.
We do punk versions of all our Christmas songs. You should try it. If you haven't, like, fucking punk screamed Holy Night.
Down on the feet of Stephen. Yeah, get into the lyrics of Good King Wenceslas.
Play it fast.
It's very bizarre, those lyrics. So anyway, fast forward. My father is now living with my partner and I. And we've got some people and we're getting ready. And I could see him. I could see him sitting in his chair.
The rage building.
The rage building and building and building. And I was just waiting. I mean, it never happened. He never officially shut up, that awful singing.
No. His move was more like just sort of mutter swearing as he walked out of the room.
When is this going to end?
Yeah.
But I'm a believer in the Will Ferrell elf philosophy of the best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud
for all to hear.
That's it. Yeah. The best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear. So this is something that we did as a tradition.
Yeah.
And then before I moved out to the country, the last one we did, if you remember this, Risa, I had recently watched like a short form doc about homelessness and menstruation.
Yes.
And what a difficult fucking process that is to deal with. And so I knew that there were already going to be 5 or 6 people coming over. So I asked everybody to bring a couple boxes of tampons.
Yeah.
And I did what we called a tampon drive.
Yeah.
And we filled like 2 big grocery bags. And then my favorite part of the story is my husband, who looks like a lumberjack, very scary.
He's like lumberjack Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's bearded. He's big. He looks like an enforcer. And he's a contractor, so he's often covered in splashes
paint
of this and that. But he happened to be working right near Dans la Rue, which is a service for young homeless people in Montreal. So I asked him if he would drop off my giant bags of tampons.
Yes, he did.
Me. And of course, he walks up to the counter. And the woman at the counter is just like, she probably assumed he was a homeless person who had come for some aid. And she's a salut. And he just kind of thrusts these 2 giant bags of tampons at her. And she looked inside them and just kind of shrugged and said, merci. And that was the end of it. But I guess all this to say, you can switch up your secret Santa, maybe. We all have too much stuff, those of us who, like, live in this very privileged, you know, world that we are very lucky to inhabit. But I felt much better about my 2 grocery bags full of tampons than I would have with whatever else might have been brought
to the
party.
I don't know if I told you, but I played the Passover holiday show that year, and I wrote to Noah, who's a wonderful local organizer here in Montreal, because he takes donations at the door, and he was asking for canned goods, and I told him, I sent him links and told him, you know, that we had sort of recently become aware of this need, especially for women who are homeless. And so he added it to all the promotional materials for Passover for like the 3 years after that. So people were coming.
The smallest things you can do can have a rippling effect.
Yeah. And you never know where things end. Sometimes you'll hear 10 years later that you had an impact on somebody, and sometimes you'll never hear.
Hearing about it is not the thing. We've encountered this so many times with so many of our witches who were vindicated like decades after they died, even.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like a main thruster that I come back to in most of my writing, is that you just have to do the thing and not be so, because you really can't know. You genuinely cannot know how your actions are going to affect people, for better and for worse people. I'm not just talking about community care. I'm also talking about being a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
You don't know how you're going to affect people. So you have to be conscious of that, but at the same time, you just have to let it go.
Yeah.
And trust your vision.
Do your best thing. So this feels like a good segue to tell you the end, or at least the next piece of my Christmas story.
Oh, yes.
So,
oh, right. We never resolved it.
And I was leaving it hanging to the perfect entry point. You just delivered it to me on the plate. So years go by. Angsty teenage Christmas is alone. Pretty sad about it, actually.
That's
over time.
That's pretty fucking sad, bro.
Like
I'm surprised that I've never heard about this before. And all your Christmas joy that we shared.
And I've had beautiful Christmases also, but I just never went to that part of the family for many years. And it was hard. My sisters would go, and they had these bonds with people and I felt like there was this secret that no one knew, that I had had this painful encounter, and I wasn't. And somehow it was never resolved. And I really thought of my stepdad's father as like a very violent person. Like I thought I had been like expelled from the family because I had called out some violence. You know?
And that's something that happens.
And that happens a
for
lot.
For real, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And finally I was in my mid-20s and I was seeing a life coach, which is like a therapist, but they talk to you a lot about what you want for future outcomes and less like about what you went through in the past. Mm-hmm. And some of them are like cheesy and shitty, and some of them are fucking incredible. Mm-hmm. And some of them are witches, you know, because they're really just going to talk to you about how you're going to change the world that you're in. And that's what we do as witches. And this woman asked me, and I was talking to her about this and kind of realizing that this was a way that my life was frozen, that I didn't have a resolution to this, and it just sat in my heart and came up every year, and it was a wall between me and my family. And she asked me, well, what's your ideal? Like, what do you want coming up? Like, what's the dream vision? How does the universe change? What does it look like? And there was a wedding anniversary coming up for my stepdad's sister and her partner. So
that side of the
family. That side of the family, you know? And I was like, I want to go. I want to stop not going. I want to go. I want to dance at the party. I want to leave it all behind. Like, I actually don't want like a big fight and a tearful resolution and calling it out and stuff. Like, I also just know that's not really possible. And like, that's not what I need. When I look in my heart, what I need to dance at this celebration and just like have my hair flying and be with my sisters and not give a fuck. Like, I want to dance at their party mm-hmm. and be unwounded or mm-hmm. like, or carry my wound, like a part of the joyful bouquet that is myself and just be there.
I love it.
I want to go, basically. And she was like, well, think about that and then think about what you're gonna wear, you know. It was amazing. And I wore a green wool dress and I went with my family and I danced at the party. And that was, I didn't really talk to the grandparents that much. It was polite, but I danced with my family and I was there. And I went to one or two things after that. And then my grandfather got very sick and he was in the hospital. And I went with my sisters and my stepdad. And he was in hospice care. And on my way there with my mom, separate in a car, we were taking two cars for some reason, I talked to her for the first time about this memory of mine, you know, and her telling me and crying upstairs and the shaking and the violence and never going back. And she said, yeah, it was horrible when we drove away that day. The last time you were there, I don't know if you remember, but your grandfather drove in the car next to us for 20 minutes crying. I didn't see him. I didn't know. I was crying, you know? If I had known, it was a wound for him too. Mm-hmm. You know, I stayed away for a long time and he didn't want me to stay away and he didn't want me to be hurt or scared. He didn't want any of that to happen. He was a flawed, big lumberjack flawed person, mm-hmm. you know? Anyway, I heard that story and I went in. And he was in hospice care and he was in his chair and he was like, so happy that I was there.
Yeah.
He took my hand and like, I realized in that moment, like, I'm not going to get a big conversation about this. That's not something that's emotionally available to either of us. Mm-hmm. But that's also fine. Like, maybe that's something that happens in a different sphere. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's something that happens in my ritual or in my fucking journal or something. But in this moment, what I get is he's holding my hand. I'm happy. He has tears in his eyes.
I mean, he's what, like, words are there that could
you came.
Talk that?
You came, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
And so, in a way, this family that was never mine is, like, very much in my heart. And I think that it does go back to chosen family in a circuitous way. Mm-hmm. Because I think if there are people in your life that you want, or if there are places you want to be and feel like you're allowed to take up space, you want to dance at those parties, mm-hmm. like, I want that to be available to you.
Yes.
And no one gives you that permission but you, really,
yeah.
you know, to
yeah.
feel loved and whole and welcome in a space. People might be assholes, but, like, you are whole and you are welcome mm-hmm. in this world.
Yeah. And chances are the people that are going to have a problem with you, especially as a child, are bringing their own baggage. I mean, I have a stepfather, and he said to me once, as an adult, you know, he and my mother got together when I was 11. And one time when I was in my 20s, he said to me, you know, we were fighting. I had come home for a visit, which inevitably turned into a fight. And yeah. he said to me, you know, Amy, I knew we weren't going to get along before I even met you.
Oh.
And yeah, you're kind of like, Ooh. But for me, that was a fucking gift that he gave me. Because in that moment, I knew it wasn't anything I had done.
That's right.
It had nothing to do with me. He literally told me, before I met you, this and that and this and that. And I felt this, like, weight lift from my shoulders because for, you know, 15 years, I had assumed it was me, that I was the problem, you know? And there were so many things that we fought about, that are really, really personal for him. If it were just personal for me, I would tell you. Yeah. But that if I had had certain pieces of information that were kept from me, those fights would never have happened.
Right.
You know? So again, we were talking about vulnerability and honesty. Yeah. And my entire life would have been different if my parents, my stepfather and my mother had been honest with me.
Yeah.
You know, about many things. Yeah. Not just this, like, thing that I'm thinking of in particular, but... there were just no conversations. It was like, this is where you live now. This is who lives in your house now.
Yeah.
You know, I was raised by television and a lot of what I learned about life came from television. And on television, they would have these things called family meetings where everyone would sit down and talk about what was happening. And other, like, this was not something that occurred in my house. It was like, there's a new sheriff in town and he doesn't fucking like you.
Right. He decided.
And he decided before he met you that he didn't like you, and it didn't matter how much you tried to connect with him, it really didn't matter. And so again, that was like this theme of chosen family. This was someone that my mother chose to be in my family, that I had no say about, but I also didn't have this biological thread. You know, he and I have gotten to a better place. It's certainly not a perfect relationship, and I definitely still, I try not to envy. It's not a good look for me, but I see people who have these, like, very, very, very familial relationships with their step families, where it's not even a question, that it's just like, we're all the same, and we're, you know, so yeah, I envy that in my darker moments, for sure. But I also, again, like, I don't have a big extended family. My father's side of the family all lived in Hungary, and I never met most of them. So a lot of, people that I choose to spend my time with are the people that I'm choosing to spend my time with, especially now. Recently, and I, as you all know, we both live in the woods, and so it's not like the drop-by culture that we were used to before. So it has to be very intentional for me to spend time with people, which is really works well for me in my sort of half hermit, half love bug. And like, I feel like my partner has my back so fundamentally, and that to me is like the measure. Like, do I feel like this person would stand up for me if I weren't in the room? Do I feel like this person, you know, when people are talking shitty about somebody else, I always have to think to myself, is this how they talk about me when I'm not in the room? You know, and some of us are lucky that we get to choose who we spend time with. Some of us do not get to choose. Some of us have to choose either or. Some people have to make an either or decision about who they're going to spend their time with. For example, queer people whose parents or extended family are homophobes. And so you can't bring Benjamin with you because, you know, it's going to make problems, you know? And if that's the case, I really would suggest that you choose the people who make you feel good about yourself. If you have to choose between your family obligation or your best friend and a hot cocoa and a blanket, like, y'all, do what's right for you.
Find that friend. And keep working and moving in circles and volunteering and finding activist circles and art circles and going to queer shelters and stuff until you find your safe place, you know? Like, you'll find them.
And speaking of this, we're going to throw now to an interview with some amazing witches / community builders / a couple of gents who have been a couple since high school and have taken that love for each other and just put it into our community.
Coven mothers.
You might know them as Ryan and Matthew, but you more likely know them if you know them as as Selma God and Uma God. So take a listen now to a conversation real quick that I had with them and their thoughts on the idea of chosen family. I'm so excited to be sitting with two of my favorite queens in all the land, Selma and Uma God. If you could start by introducing yourselves so our listeners know whose voice is who and who they're hearing.
So I'm Uma God. I'll be speaking in my regular voice today, just for clarity's sake.
Can we hear Uma's voice just for a second so our listeners
so
get
you might know me a little better on stage with a little bit of an accent and, you know, a slightly different voice, but just to keep people from bleeding out of their ears, I'm going to talk like this.
Perfect. And I'm going to try to keep my laughter out of my microphone if that voice does come up again. I love it. And Selma?
Yes, and this is Selma God, Mistress of Business, and the Supreme of Montreal Coven.
I'm clapping my hands, not too loudly, but yeah, I love that show. And you two kind of inspired this year's Yule episode theme of chosen family because you're witches, but you've also really built a family together, like together and within your community. So we'll get into your shows and everything and all the amazing drag stuff and your beautiful coupleness and love and regard for each other. But I want to start sort of from scratch and ask, what is a witch and how do you fit into that?
I mean, I have been practicing some form of witchcraft ever since I was in the sixth grade. And I kind of am one of those people that's like very vague and just kind of like, if you say you're a witch, you're probably a witch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the, you know, working magic aspect, but then, you know, we've seen a bajillion and four ways to work magic. So like, I'm not going to judge.
Certainly. Yeah, we always say it's the least labely label of all labels because it really can mean anything that you decide that
yeah,
it means.
Exactly.
And how do you practice, if you don't mind getting into that a little bit? Like, what is your personal practice like?
So this is Uma again. We've been told that we sound the same on the phone, so I just wanted to clarify.
Thank you.
So, yeah, my personal practice, I mean, it's evolved over the many years that I've been practicing. But, you know, I tend to do I have an overlap between my religion and my witchcraft. But there's this side that's very kind of like herbally sachets and you know, a lot of bathtub witchery is mm-hmm. what I specialize in. So, you know, candles and herbs and flowers and that kind of thing. And then in my religious side, I am a Hellenic polytheist. So I worship Dionysus and the ancient Greek gods. And I try to do it in a historically informed way. And then in my worship, I tend to use aspects of my witchcraft as well. So they kind of like cross over a lot.
And how did you get drawn to these particular deities?
Actually, it's kind of funny because, like, you know, being the typical weirdo kid that, you know, couldn't be conformist in any way whatsoever, like, when you start researching, you know, like what ends up being like Neo-Wicca, you know, mm-hmm. that's the gateway into so much witchcraft for a lot of people. The first thing that comes up is the ancient Greek gods, right? And so I was like, ugh, that's so basic. I'm not even... And then I went the better part of like 15 years kind of feeling that way. And then I went to a pagan festival and I had been growing out my hair and somebody gave me a flower crown. And then somebody looked at me and was like, oh my God, you look like Dionysus, which was really rich because I'm straight. I was straight edge at the time. And so for those of you that don't know, Dionysus is the god of wine and revelry, right? So like party hardy, right?
And you were not consuming these things.
Exactly. I was partying and like we used to go to raves and everything, but I was not consuming in any way, shape or form. And so I thought that was really funny. But then it kind of like crept up on me that like everywhere I started going, there was all of these symbols and these like I was getting vibes and messages, kind of feelings from Dionysus. And then my whole life went into chaos. And then as I was researching him, it was like, oh, P.S. He's a life ruiner in the best way possible.
Sort of like the tower in the tarot.
Exactly, yes. That's very that vibe. And so I was just like, okay, listen, like, I've avoided this my whole life. Let's see what happens if I dive in and, you know, I've been doing it now for 6 or 7 years, just kind of like worshiping Dionysus in that way. So, yeah.
And are you still straight edge?
I am not, although I've never done any drugs. I'm kind of waiting for that moment where it's like, okay, this is it. This is the moment when I'm going to do it.
100 years old, by the way.
When we're 200 years old, I'm finally going to do it, and it's going to be like a big experience. I've decided it's going to be like one of the, like a big devotional act. I drink occasionally, but like, just because like, I like the taste of certain like, cute drinks, and that's about it.
Delicious cocktails.
Exactly, yeah.
And so, Selma, your show, you do a monthly that's called Coven. Why this?
Okay, so I'll go back to the original question and then meld into this one.
Oh, yes, please.
I am not a particularly religious person, but I am a very, how could I put this? I strongly believe in the energies we put out and witchcraft and how to harness that energy. So to me, being a witch and witchcraft is channeling your energy towards goals. If you haven't noticed, I am the mistress of business. I am a very pragmatic person. And to me, witchcraft is one of the ways to obtain your goals and one of the ways to focus your energies and your life.
I love this that you say like a business, but I know it's not like some capitalist greedy. When you do your shows, you do like an even door split, I think, between everyone who performs. So how do you negotiate the business queen with the community building altruistic queen?
Well, to me, that's part of business, right? Business doesn't mean capitalism. Business just means any form of exchange of energies, right? So for me, the moniker of mistress of business is just someone who is going to organize things in a way to achieve a goal. That is business, right? Let's be honest here.
Getting shit done.
Yeah, exactly. It's getting shit done. And doing business doesn't mean being a capitalist asshole necessarily. It's what our society has brought it to. Mm. But there's so much many other ways of doing business. And I think I'm one of the people that proves in our community here that you can do business in a way that's sustainable and can lift everybody up. And that's one of the things I am very vocal about all the time. And it's very important to me.
Yeah, I've been to a few of the Coven shows, and they're always very emotional. And part of that is because of the way that you host. It's like very welcoming and very, I mean, it's tongue in cheek. And, you know, there are bratty moments, too. Of course, it's a drag show. But the underlying current is like, you know, you are beautiful talking to the audience, talking to the performers. You bring your audience up on stage to have their own moment. So, again, I'll ask both of you, like, why is that so important to you? Why is this community building and uplifting, I guess maybe is a better word, aspect of what you do so important to you?
Okay, so it's a big question.
Yeah.
So of it, and maybe, oh, well, we'll probably have stuff to add in a different direction to go with it. But let's just start with the aspect of drag, first of all. Drag has exploded over the past 10 years. A big part of that is thanks to Drag Race.
RuPaul's Drag Race, yeah.
RuPaul's Drag Race. Unfortunately, the show's not perfect, and neither is RuPaul. So let's be real here. There's some, you know, very problematic behaviors and things that have been said. And different people have different opinions. But, you know, first of all, I think drag is for everybody, not just for cis white gay men. So that's the first thing of wanting to build communities and make a difference. So for those of you that are not familiar with drag, I mean, I'm not going to go and do the whole tirade about the difference between Drag Race, Dragula, and drag ethics. It's something you can look up really easily. We've done a bunch of interviews about it. If you look up our names, you'll find a bunch of stuff, I promise.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think there's sort of like what y'all are doing is more like closer to Dragula than to Drag Race. And by that, I mean, not just the dark witchiness, but also the gender inclusivity, the broader range of what is being allowed to be called drag in that moment or to win a crown or whatever.
Yeah. So I started basically doing Coven because Moxie Hollow, who used to do drag with Uma under another name, quit drag and was like, oh, I'd like to start doing it again. I was like, oh yeah, you know, I could do that. We could do a weird show. I produce a bunch of monthly shows already. Why not do another one? And I just started coming. That's how Selma started. I was just like, yeah, let's do this. and honestly, it just, I've been floored with the amount of support and how much this show means to everybody in the community, because it does mean a lot to me, but I wasn't expecting to have this big of a reception on the audience end for the show. And I think for me, what makes it super important, and I think what works for the audience, is that it's not just a show of like, look how fabulous I am on stage. It's a show of, yeah, look how fabulous I am on stage, and look how amazing we can all be together. And let's voice these opinions and these thoughts, and let's be there for each other. I think that's the, that to me is what coven is, right? It is a coven. We're there to lift each other's energies up. And you know what? Fuck shit up, because being kind and docile isn't always the answer. Sometimes being angry is the right way to do things, and there needs to be space for that. Even when you look at more liberal left spaces, I think we forget that we can also be angry, and that's okay.
And that's how we get shit done oftentimes. If you're not angry, then what are you going to change? It's fine. All this is fine. This oppression is fine.
Yeah, there's a place for everybody, and everybody's needed. But yeah, I think Uma has something to add there.
I mean, just for me, in terms of why the community aspect is so important to the drag that we make, honestly, it all comes back to my first experiences with real live drag performers. Unfortunately, my first experiences were not positive with them. A lot of drag at the time where I'm from was kids who were bullied for being femme, for being queer. They were bullied, and then now that they had started doing drag, they were the queens of the community, so they became the bullies.
Mm-hmm.
And drag was just kind of their opportunity to be mean to people with, like, a free license to do whatever they wanted, to touch people how they wanted, to comment on people's bodies and how they do things and how they talk and how they dance, and I hated it. It actually made me not want to do drag.
Yeah.
And so when I started doing drag, I said, you know, like, I'm going to be an auntie. I'm going to be the nice one that makes people want to come in to see the show. I want people to leave my show feeling like they've been seen, like they've been uplifted. I mean, of course, you know, like, I've got snarky comments for everything. I'm a very sarcastic person, but I never want to turn it on the audience. You know, punching up is fine sort of deal. But mm-hmm. to me, that's part of the reason why community was so important. But also, when I started drag, we started outside of the village. We weren't relying on the system that was already in place to get our names and our shows out there. And so the only way that we were going to be able to have an audience was for us to reach out to them and to make them feel like they wanted to be there. We were starting a new thing at the time. There was nobody else out of the village that was really doing exactly what we were doing. And so a big part of it was like, we have to create the community that we want, and that community is not going to stick around if we don't make them feel good about being there. So you kind of, you get into it on like a practical level, and then the more community that you build up, the more you support, the more you reach out, the more you like, the more they support, the more people you meet, and it just gets bigger and bigger.
And it sort of has become this beacon of light. Like, Selma, can you tell the story of, I believe it was Damon who showed up looking for, yeah, you tell the story.
So Damon Leslave, who's a super, super talented drag performer in the city here, did a few drag competitions in the village and auditions, and they were like, you know what? You should really go check House of Laureen out, because I think you would fit in. You're weird. You would fit in there. So we're just getting ready at Cleo's for when we had our monthly show there, and this young guy walks in and walks straight to the bar to see the bartender, who's Alain there, and he says, oh, people told me to come here to get booked. And Alain just says, oh, no, don't talk to me about that. You have to talk to Selma. So Damon comes on, walks up to me and says, hey, people told me I was too weird for the village and to come see you about doing shows. And I was like, oh, okay. Obviously, being who I am, I always try to make it out to all the events that have newbies for drag. So I had seen Damon perform a few times. I was like, yeah, absolutely. You're young. You have a lot of stuff to learn. But I can see the energy there and the talent is there. So absolutely. And we've been working with Damon ever since. So she's been a staple in most of our shows, honestly.
Yeah, and an incredible performer who came to you because they were too weird for this. And I love that. Too weird is like, come to me. Someone told you you're too weird. Come unto me. Be with me.
Yeah, you mean I wish, you know, I we have Coven now that's every month and Uma does church. And like, I wish we could book 20 more performers a month, you know, but like, at the end of the day, I only have so much energy and I need to make sure that there's going to be an audience for all the shows so I can pay everybody. Cause that is a part of business that in our capitalist society, you know, I'm putting out shows and I want everybody to have a good time, but I can't do this for free. I need to pay my rent and so do my artists, you know? So there has to be that balance of we give the audience what they want and we do what we want as art, right? You have to find that fine line, which I think Coven has done a really good job of doing. Like Coven, we have some really freaking weird art. But we've found an audience that's there for that art and willing to partake in it and make it a community, you know?
So let's get back to a more normalized version of family.
Yeah.
You two are a couple and you have been for a long time. Can you tell me your cute meet cute? What do they call it? Meet cute. How did you meet? How did you know that each other was the one? Give some advice to our listeners who are looking to find their soulmate. That's not too big of a question, is it?
Yes, one out of all the ones so far.
Yeah. It's actually, okay, so this seems to be like a running theme throughout my life where like something happens and I'm like, hell no. And then it ends up becoming my life. So Selma and I actually met online on a website for ravers in Ottawa. And when we started talking, both of us thought that the other one was just like, hell no. I thought Selma was crazy.
I am.
Yeah. And then Selma thought that I was annoying.
You are.
I am. But like we had no interest in the other one beyond like, you know, being casually community member friends, right? Like we were both candy ravers. And so like there was shared interest, but like neither of us was chasing the other down. And then we spoke for months and then finally met in person. And then that just cemented the hell no-ness of it all. And then randomly at the next rave that we went to together, like I was tired at one point and I like took like a 10-minute nap with my head in Selma's lap. And then on the bus ride back from the party, Selma slept on my shoulder and then we were dating.
It's very eighth grade. You sat together on the bus and held hands and that was
it. It was almost eighth grade.
Yeah, it was 10th grade actually.
In high school, that's right. You met in high school.
Yeah, graduation.
And so, okay, now I have to ask that. Our listeners don't know specifically how old you are, and I won't ask, but we'll assume that 10th grade was a little while ago. How do you keep love alive in the dark times? I mean, this is a Yule episode. It's going to be dark from 9 a.m. to, I mean, 9 p.m. You know what I mean.
Basically, the darkness does start at 9 a.m., let's be real.
Yeah, when I open my eyes. Hello, darkness, my old friend. So, yeah, how have you managed to navigate this complicated world as a team?
Okay, well, first of all, every relationship is different, right? So let's, because like what works for us might not work for somebody else. And that's,
There's no one solution for love?
Right? It sounds silly to say this way, but I always have to say, because people look at us and like, oh, how do you do it? And then they listen to our story and they're like, I would never do that. I'm like, yeah, I know, but it works for me and it could work for somebody else. But people often, you know, love is romanticized. I know it sounds silly, but love is romanticized. You look at books, you look at movies. We're taught that love works a certain way and there's a formula to it. But like you've just said, in fact, there's many formulas and they all work differently for different people. I think the most important thing is to be able to truthfully communicate with each other, but also with yourself. And what works for us and has worked over the years, I think, is that we're both very, very, very passionate people. And we're very willing to be there for each other, for our passions, and we want to live life to the fullest. And that's what we do and makes us happy. So you know, being two passionate people, yeah, we do fight. We fight every day. You know, we'll get mad at each other every freaking day. And that's fine, because we know that in the end we're going to move beyond it and get to the next thing and be there for each other and listen and grow from that experience, right? Some people might say, oh, fighting every day would be exhausting for me. I could never do that. And that's probably true for them, you know?
Yeah, well, we were talking about earlier, like, this sort of justified anger and people who are in their relationships and are just keep shoving it down. And oh, I'm not going to say anything. Oh, I don't want to make him mad. I don't want to this and that. And then it comes out in other more nefarious ways, I think. I mean, my partner and I always say we've been together for a long time too, and I say, you know, we fight more than I've ever fought in any other relationship up to this point, but we also resolve more issues than I've ever resolved with any other partner up to this point.
And I mean, I think it's something that's worth mentioning outside of a romantic relationship, especially since you're talking about, like, it's that holiday time of year right now. Like, even when you're dealing with your family, The fights sometimes can be healthy, right? Like, you have something to say and you have something to learn. And that's the big thing with Selma and I, is that when we fight, every fight is for a reason. It's often because of the same reason over and over and over again, but there's always a reason, and we both recognize that. So, like, it's not don't fight, and it's not wrap up every fight with a cute little bow. It's make every fight worthwhile. Every time you fight, make sure that you've expressed something that you needed to express, but also maybe that you've heard something that your partner, whether, like, the fight partner, so whether it's someone in your family, a friend, your boss, your lover, who cares, but maybe you've heard something that they needed to express. Because if you're just fighting to get your point out, then, like, it's not going to go anywhere. But make every fight count, honestly, is one of the biggest things that has helped our relationship. And it's something that people don't talk about, because it makes it sound like we're in a weird, unhealthy relationship. But I think it's so normal.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you brought up the extending this into everyone in your life too. Like you said, it's the holiday season. So when you're dealing with your family, I think choosing your battles, but making every fight count is very, very, very good advice. Because we've seen, maybe your experience has been different, but to me, I've seen a lot of intersection between queer people and witches. Have you found that?
Oh, absolutely.
And so
I actually used to work at the store here in Montreal, Mélange Magique.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I used to be the president of the Montreal Pagan Resource Center, and I worked at Mélange Magique. And so, like, this conversation would come up a lot, where it was, does witchcraft break people, or do broken people come to witchcraft? I think it's both.
You break in the tower way. Yeah, definitely.
It's why we have so much crossover with, like, the queer community. It's these people that are searching for their power because they feel less than or broken or helpless, and then that's where we all find it, right? But sorry, continue. You were saying something.
No, that was my question. Like, can you talk about this intersection between queerness and witchness? And then part B of my question, I guess, is dealing with your family or people's families as a queer person or as a witch or whatever, I'm using air quotes here, difference you might be bringing to your family, and just how to navigate all of that. Yeah, that's not even a question. That was like, write us a manifesto in the next 7 minutes.
put something to light here that was really interesting is that often people that are broken or seeking some power are attracted to witchcraft. And I think the big part for me in that is when you're victim to a situation or something happens, it's the sensation of being powerless, right? And that's the sensation that nobody wants to be stuck with, because who wants to be powerless? And witchcraft is one of the ways that you can gain control and power over your life. And I think that's one of the biggest draws to it. And once you realize that you can apply that type of potential to everything in your life, that you, yes, things can happen that are outside of your control, but there's always something you can do, you know?
Like, when people think of witchcraft, whether you're thinking religious witchcraft or secular witchcraft, everyone always thinks of like a cauldron and a candle and herbs and a, you know, pricking your finger and the whole thing, right? But let's be real here. After a certain point, all witches eventually just start banging pots. Being like, get the fuck out, negativity. Like, you know, when you're in your car and you're like, gee, I really hope I get a parking space. Like, all you do is wiggle your fingers and you're like, witchcraft.
I'm good at that one.
Right?
Yeah. I think we all start with a lot of accoutrements and then we just come down to the 10 magic wands that we have attached to our hands. Fingers.
And like that's one of those things where it's like that's the power that you're finding inside of yourself. And like the more like you said, the accoutrements are very important. And then but eventually we start finding that power within ourselves and we can handle the bare bones of, you know, a last second spell. And I think that that's a really beautiful part of that progression in our lives is that eventually we do find that power that we're looking for, hopefully.
Yeah.
When it comes to family and stuff like that, I mean, when I came out, I was a neo-Wiccan at first. That's basically, I went to Catholic school until the sixth grade. I did my confirmation and then, my godmother, who, for those that don't understand what a godmother is, your godmother is basically, if your parents die, your godparents are the people that are in charge of your spiritual well-being within the church. So for my confirmation, my godmother gave me a book on Greek mythology. So the day I stood in front of the church and said, I believe in the Lord God, our Savior, the Holy Catholic Church, the spirit of all of this, she gave me a book on Greek mythology. So obviously she was off to a good start. and then I immediately converted to Neo-Wicca that summer. A little while later, I came out to her and basically, she looked at me and she was like, I'm worried that you're joining a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her, I was like, it's like the least culty thing that I could be doing because there's no central power. I can't give money to anybody. I don't know anyone. So we're safe.
And, that's bang on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's basically all ever since then, I've just decided like, I don't have to tell anybody. None of my family is involved in my spiritual life. They never were. Even when I was, you know, Catholic, they weren't really involved in my inside spiritual life. And so they don't necessarily know what I get up to. So I'm blessed that I have a family that, like, knows about my otherness. And anytime I tell them anything, they're kind of like, oh, well, yeah. You know, I tell them that I'm moving to Montreal. I tell them that, you know, I'm gonna get married to a guy. I tell them that I can say that I'm a Dionysian. I can say I'm a witch. I can say I do this, that, and the other thing. I'm doing drag, and basically everyone just kind of goes like, "Stop trying to one up yourself."
Yeah, I think both of us are very blessed that we have very accepting families that are very open and very close to us, right? Like, we're both very lucky to have that type of family dynamic. That being said, we touched really briefly on the aspect of chosen family, and I think that's a very important part of our lives, too, as queer people, and often even as witches. It's surrounding yourself with people that you connect with and making bonds that are important, right? And that's what family's about. It's being there for each other through the good times and the bad times, and I think having that network can really be a lifesaver.
And I know that that's also, again, part of why community is so important to us, is that Selma and I, we do recognize that we have a lot of privileges in our lives, and whether it's you know, financial or familial or, you know, any kind of privilege, we have a lot of them.
Yeah.
And so that means that we've got a lot of spoons. We've got a lot of spoons to spare, and so that's why we've always tried to make a space for people that need family. We know that ours will support us, and so we're out here trying to support people that need it. That's one of the big reasons why we've had such a commitment to this aspect of building community and recognizing our community, but not just saying like our community in the broad sense, but like really stopping and getting to know some of these people. Like, I know when a particular member of our community has had a concussion, and because she gets a lot of them, and I know the story behind all of them, and like,
mm-hmm.
I know when someone's having a hard time with their family, and so we're there for them, and that's part of the reason is because we have such a great family background that we want to share that with people.
And I mean, people feel, I think that connection that we want to have is real, because we have people constantly messaging us, talking to us, and we have that relationship with, yes, they're audience members, but they are our extended family. You know, if someone writes me and say, hey, the thing that happened in your show made me really uncomfortable, I'll take the time to listen to them and understand and have a conversation with them about it, because I'm not just putting on a show for my own pleasure. I'm there. It's supposed to be there for everybody. And, you know, talking about witchcraft and everything, I mean, I think everybody that knows me, and especially Uma, can attest to this. I'm very much your guardian archetype. I'm the protector, the guardian, the justice seeker.
The Aquarian.
Yeah. I think that's something I try to really project in Coven. That's like, you know, I'm the main host, and that's something I want to project to people, is that you're safe here, you know?
And you always make sure to bring up that message at the start of, I mean, all the covens that I've been to, it's like a call to arms, you know, not hugging arms, but a call to arms nonetheless, against capitalism, against the patriarchy specifically. Why do you feel like that's so important to start your shows with this empowerment, political empowerment?
Honestly, because I think that's one of the things that makes us feel the most like victims right now. It sucks all the energy out of all of us. The need to be productive, the need to make money, the need to be part of this capitalist system to survive. And let's be real here, the world is on fire right now when you look around us. And that sense of helplessness is just exhausting. But knowing that we're there for each other and we're fighting alongside each other can be really uplifting. And knowing that someone else gets it, and you don't have to explain why you're depressed, why you don't want to get out of bed, why going to your 9-to-5 job is a nightmare, even if you love it or it pays well, you don't need to explain that. I get it. You're in a system that sucks the life out of you. And you know what? Yeah, we have to operate within it now, but it doesn't mean that we can't be there for each other and keep fighting it.
Beautifully said. Do you have any special longest night of the year messages for our listeners before I let you get back to your busy, busy lives?
I mean, I think it's just kind of like that classic imagery of like there's light coming. You know, you might be facing the wrong way in the darkness. You don't see where the light is coming from. You might not see it because it's just starting to grow. You might not see it because there's an obstacle in the way, but the light is there. And, you know, we're in for the long night, but, you know, we're gonna dance. We're gonna dance until dawn, baby. That's what we're here for.
I love that. Thank you so much. Happy Yule. I'm going to throw now to my conversation with Monifa Walker, who's going to give us some astrological tips going into the new year. But thank you so much to the gods. Can you drop your socials or any kind of links that you want our listeners to know about you, or last thoughts, anything?
If you want to follow us on the social medias, you can look us up, Uma and Selma God, and God is GAHD, like hot damn. like hot dogs. So GAHD. You can find us on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. We're all on Facebook. Or you can look up House of Laureen to know when we're doing different shows. But yeah, I mean, we're here for you. We want to be there for everybody as much as we can be. So come to the shows, give us a message, say hi. Like we love to hear from everybody. So thank you all so much, and God bless.
God bless. Next time we have you on the show, we'll get into why you named yourselves the gods, but we'll save that one for next time. Thank you so much, and Merry Yule to you both.
To you as well.
You too.
Merry Yule, Monifa!
Merry Yule, hello.
Merry Yule. So some of our listeners might recognize you because you were on our Beltane Music Witches special earlier this year. And you're here today to give us some astrology tips and tricks for the new year. But before we deep dive into all that, can you tell us about the musical composition project that you're working on that's related to all this?
It's 12 Preludes of the Zodiac. That's not going to be the album title, by the way, but it is essentially 12 short preludes for each Zodiac sign, and then there's going to be some additional tracks at the end from other classical composers, and two will be from more modern day artists, like 21st century artists. So it's like a piano cover of a couple of songs, but yeah.
That's going to be awesome. I'm super excited. So we'll put the link to your Kickstarter on our socials and in the show notes for this. I'm super excited. I hope you get tons of money for this. I'm excited to hear.
Thank you. I'll definitely mail you a copy next year when it's finished.
Thank you. So your astrology business proper is called Sekhmet's Visions. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose that name for people who didn't hear you on our other episode?
Various reasons. Actually, the understanding has got deeper since we've last spoken. One is definitely in Egyptian astrology, my birth date actually falls under the goddess Sekhmet, so she rules my actual time of birth, date of birth. And also various dreams that I had. I don't know if anyone, if they have or haven't worked with older, more ancient crone-like deities and gods and spirits and teletarkies, but they tend to visit you more in your dreams and visualizations first as a way of like introducing yourself. All beings from other realms do that, but especially the older ones, that's their way of kind of making a declaration they want to cultivate a relationship with you. And that's what happened with me last year in January. I just kept getting these dreams, and I was like, okay, I'm listening. And then it is interesting, even after changing my business name, there are still a few things I had to integrate about the energy itself. So I had some very interesting experiences. but yeah, it's helped me to grow really fast, a lot, much quicker. And it's also something that I now integrate in my one-on-one work when I do like spiritual coaching and shadow integration with people. So yeah, it's definitely expanded in less than a year, and the goddess Sekhmet has been a big part of that, because she's all about drive and courage and a deep, deep healing. And it's like, there's no point me offering to help others to heal themselves if I'm not doing that work first. So it's all fallen synchronistically in place. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned a lot of these messages came in dreams, and you mentioned shadow integration. So since we're at Yuletide, which is this dark, dark time of the year, let's talk a bit about not demonizing the dark. Because you said dreams are obviously I'm using air quotes here, but a dark place. But they're also a very creative space. Same with, you know, the womb or planting a seed underground. Like, a lot of creation takes place in these very dark spaces. So can you get into your perception of shadow work just a little bit?
The first thing that I'd say is that creativity is related to divine feminine. So already there's been like this unconscious conditioning that to be fear of darkness, to be fear of creativity, is to be fear of the divine feminine within you, or also known as the anima, as people like Carl Jung used to describe it as. And in my experience, the more you're focusing on just being good and just being positive and just being righteous, and what I like to claim, when somebody doth protest too much about those things, what I actually observe happens, and even in some experiences in my past, is that you start experiencing things in your life that your conscious self really didn't want to experience, because you've switched off to your unconscious. And what happens is, when you're switched off to your unconscious, it kind of allows anything to happen there, right? Because you're not governing it, you're not checking it out, you're not checking in to listen to it, to integrate it. So it starts acting out in more erratic ways to get your attention, usually in situations with people or happenings. And a lot of the time you'll be like, why is this happening? I don't get it. And it's a way of your unconscious trying to get your attention. Another way of trying to explain it, I don't know if anyone saw the film by Jordan Peele, Us. But that's a really good
I did.
Yeah, that's a great way of explaining shadow integration, because if all the people above ground chose to acknowledge that darker part of them that still made up a part of who they are, not just who they are entirely, would they have acted out in such a horrific and violent way? My guess is no, and that's what our shadow does a lot of the time. For instance, you could be somebody that says continuously, I really don't enjoy drama, I don't enjoy conflict, I don't know why I keep attracting it, it's so annoying. And then you keep falling into situations where you're continuously having conflict with people and having arguments with people until you really dig into that darker part of yourself that you've ignored, that you've denied for so long, that you, until you kind of make friends with it and come to an agreement with it. And this is something that, it, again, shows up in the dream space as well. When this integration occurs, you actually have different dreams where you realize that your light and dark can actually agree and not having to do the same thing. And when this happens, it's really interesting. You tend to co-create less of those experiences. Not to say you don't have conflicts and you don't have situations that will still irritate you, but you're not repeating the same patterns. You're evolving, and as you're evolving, obviously the tests get harder, but shadow integration is something that's definitely, it's a very deep and transformative medicine. And it goes back to Sekhmet as well. If you're going to heal, it makes sense to heal from the inside out rather than pointing at things externally to solve all of your problems for you.
And this is why I call you the astronomical psychologist, because you really, you take the stars and you take their patterns, but you really put them into like our human lives and our psyches.
Absolutely. Well, it's like astronomy is, I always say astronomy is just the study of the planets themselves. And astrology is the behavior of those planets and how they affect everything, including Earth beings, us. And something that I do actually do now when I work with people one-on-one, which many notary people have done in the past, including Carl Jung, is actually check their birth chart and actually see where they have the most fears, where they have the most blocks, the most challenges, but also as well where they have the most shadow placements, like their Black Moon Lilith, like their Psyche, even their vertex, because their position in the chart actually determine where they can get the biggest breakthrough if they choose to be brave and invest in themselves and dive deep into actually getting to, you know who they are, possibly for the first time in their life, because we're taught to only acknowledge a half of ourselves or a part of ourselves. And when we integrate our shadow, we're actually getting to know our whole selves. And that can be startling at first, naturally, of course, but then you get very, very comfortable. And then you realize that it wasn't actually you that was fearing that. You was acting on the fear of others around you if you were to have complete approval for your whole self.
I'm going to guess some of our listeners too, I find, and maybe it's the math, maybe it's the complexity, but I'm super interested in astrology, but I find it very intimidating. So for me and for our listeners who are on the same page as me, what's like a good entry point to start learning about astrology in a more defined way?
I mean, I don't know.
That's so complex that there isn't even a simple place to start.
Well, I was about to say that. I mean, personally, I'm very good with maths, so maybe I've taken that for granted. So I've always understood it. And also, there's so many connections between astrology and numerology as well, but that's for a different conversation, a different episode.
we'll have you back again.
Thank you. If anyone is, I mean, I have done many readings for people where they've had absolutely no previous knowledge to astrology. They had no clue about their chart. They only knew what their sun sign was. And I do those readings in a different way where I do break it down. But essentially, you know, if even getting to know the personal planets is too much for somebody, I'll just say get to know the three basics or the foundations, which is your ascendant, your sun and your moon. If you really want to understand how you behave, how you think, who you are on a day-to-day basis. And you can do that without having to look at all the other houses and all other planets. But I will warn you that if you are somebody that gets into astrology or likes astrology, which again is shown in your chart, you will start to eventually find your own way of digging into that, whether it's hiring somebody or investing in courses or investing in books. But yeah, for people that just look at a chart and just get nothing but confusion, I would just recommend just look at the foundation, the ascendant, the sun and the moon sign, because they're the three most important from the moment of birth. So
ascendant, sun, moon.
Yes.
Okay, I got it. So now that we're on this, oh, go ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, the moon is going to be more connected to your unconscious, your subconscious, your emotional health. The sun is going to be more connected to your ego, your confidence, and that masculine energy. The moon is more feminine energy. And your ascendant is more about your physical body and the first impression that you give people. So if you're one of those people that continuously get told, oh, when we met you, we thought you were like this, and now we realize you're like this, chances are your ascendant is different from your sun and moon sign.
That's so useful. Thank you so much. That is an excellent jumping off point for me. I feel less intimidated already. So what can you tell us about the stars for 2020, for the new year? What should our listeners be prepared for?
There's two main dates I'm going to talk about. Obviously, we all know that Jupiter is ingress Capricorn, which is going to be very interesting because it now joins that Capricorn stellium. And there's going to be, obviously there's going to be expansion in Capricorn things, and that one of the main things that Capricorn rules is institutions like the government, like the police, even institutions that are higher than that. So every country on this planet is going to be experiencing a razor focus on this area, but also they're going to see there's going to be a lot of judgment and a lot of scrutiny, and out of that judgment and scrutiny is going to come a lot of changes, and that's with the Pluto and Saturn still playing its part in that. Now, March 21st, Saturn officially ingresses Aquarius. Now, for many of us out there in their late 20s, including myself, this is the actual activation of our Saturn return for anyone that has a Saturn in Aquarius. And it's very, very, very interesting. Saturn is naturally one of the rulers of Aquarius, or the ruler, if you're talking about traditional astrology. And Aquarius is about connection, and it's about a long-term vision, you know, having what you have, you know, high hopes, friends, but it's also about freedom. And Saturn is about longevity, it's about long-term, you know, visible results, public image. And Aquarius is about publicity. So what we're all going to be activating in our lives is how can we all seek a healthier way, a better way of achieving freedom on an intellectual level, on a spiritual level, on all levels, and how can we maintain that on a long-term basis. And this is something that's going to continue on for the rest of this century, for the next century, because we are edging that ever so closer to the edge of the age of Aquarius. Sorry.
And I was going to ask about that. There's a theory that we are entering a new dawn. So a lot of us feel a bit helpless and a bit like just freaked in the face of what's going on in the world right now. But astrologically, can you tell us about this new dawn that is approaching?
It's happening now. It's something that I actually wrote about in an article that was shared on Witch magazine. We're still currently in the age of Pisces, so we're still at a point of disillusion, but we are going into the age of Aquarius. And actually the planet that's going to really display a visible shift in towards that is Jupiter. And Jupiter is one of the social planets, and Jupiter will go retrograde on May the 14th and will be direct again on September the 12th. And then towards the end of 2020, it's then going to enter Aquarius. And this is going to be a phenomenal moment for us. So you think about the things that Jupiter rules, like education, like justice, the higher self, how we think, our belief systems, even how we travel, this is all going to have a massive shift, and we're all going to witness and experience it by 2020. Most of us are going to be feeling it by March, especially those of us that are going to be activating their Saturn return in Aquarius. But for everybody globally, they won't be able to ignore it when Jupiter goes into Aquarius, because that's going to mark the first shift into how we think. And once Uranus goes into Gemini in, you know, 5-6 years' time, Pluto will be in Aquarius by then as well. So we're going to actually see a massive paradigm shift in consciousness within the next 10 years, which is very, very interesting. And, you know, there are a lot of things that we do need to address and we do need to change now. But am I one of those people that thinks that we have, you know, less than 10 years? I actually don't. But again, that's another conversation for another day.
You're hopeful. You are hopeful.
Well, you know, that is the nature. That's one of the natures of Aquarius, to have high hopes and wishes. But yeah, I am very hopeful. But not only that, my soul is knowledgeable and so is everybody else's. And once we tap into that and we align with that, a lot of fears that we've been conditioned with, that we've had hardwired into our brains for years, we will start to release. And that's all I'll say about freaking out any of your listeners, but yeah.
let's have this as our mantra then. You said, my soul is knowledgeable.
Yes.
Listeners, let's all say that together right now. My soul is knowledgeable. So return to that if you get freaked out like I do. So, okay, Monifa.
We're having a human experience. It'd be very weird if we didn't get freaked out now and again.
Especially for me, freaked out is sort of my baseline. The world is an insane place, but it's so beautiful and so hopeful. So, Monifa, can you give us like just a couple things that we should be focused on headed into the new year as we go into 2020?
Yes. Jupiter at the moment is now invisible, and he becomes visible again at the end of January. And I'll just say, get prepared for the shifts of the nodes as well that will come around about spring, summertime. They'll shift into Gemini, Sagittarius, where they're actually exalted. So for everybody, whether you study astrology or not, or you seek out an astrologer like myself, if you're in your late 20s, definitely check out your Saturn return and how best to navigate that. Because Saturn returns can be a really amazing experience to enjoy if you have the knowledge about how it's going to affect you. And also everybody check where Jupiter is, both natally and where it's going to be in your chart, where Capricorn is as well, because it's going to be a shift in expansion and growth that no one is going to be able to ignore.
So be prepared or get trampled.
Pretty much, yeah. that is the nature of Aquarius and Capricorn, you know. What are the structures in place? How can I be independent, you know, and you combine the two. It's like, well, yeah, now is the time to not make excuses and point fingers and actually be like, okay, now it's my responsibility. What can I do to improve things? What can I do to be the good that you seek, you know?
And trust that my soul is knowledgeable.
Exactly.
Thank you so much. Can you tell us your links one more time for our listeners who might want to contact you? By the way, Monifa is in London, England. Mary Ewell, all the way from England. So especially if you happen to be
here, by the way.
If any of our listeners are in the UK, you definitely want to hit her up. Otherwise, you can definitely do that online. So tell us your links one more time, and then we'll wish you a merry Yule and a good sleep.
Thank you. And thank you for having me back, by the way. Yeah.
Thank you for coming. You're a joy and a treasure. You know that.
Oh, thank you. my business is secmetsvisions.co.uk. And everything that's connected to my business, my Patreon, my YouTube, my Instagram, it's all connected on my website. And if you want to donate to my crowdfund to get my astrological music out, it's kickstarter.com/projects/Mia Skywalker. If you can't remember that, just type Mia Walker and you'll find me as well.
Mia Skywalker. That's so appropriate.
That's a nickname given to me by a boss of mine. Really, really cool nickname. It's stuck with me ever since.
I love it. It's very appropriate. Thank you so much again, Monifa, and Merry Yule to you.
Merry Yule to you. Thank you. Take care.
So Merry Yule, everybody.
Merry Yule, my love.
We love you so much, and we just want you to embrace this darkness that is in the world right now.
If you're in the Southern Hemisphere, embrace the light.
Yay! It's your Letha. Happy Letha. But yes, in conclusion, we want you to choose people that respect you. We want you to choose to be around people who have your back. Mm. We want you to choose to be around people who want you to be who you are.
Yeah.
Please.
Be safe and be kind and find people who are kind to you.
Yeah. We love you.
We love
Have
you.
Have a very, very happy Yule, and we'll see you next year.
Get up, get in the sun for like an hour, get some vitamin D, get some sun rays, and then if you want to go back to bed, fine, but at least you know you've got that exposure to improve your health in the long term.
That's it,
we love you.
We love you. So